From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the program, why the debate over a new basketball arena is so contentious. Then, inside the distinctive way Wisconsinites talk. Later, a project documents some compelling Wisconsin stories.
What we've done is given undergraduate students the opportunity to hear the stories of powerful, empathetic, action-oriented Latinas over the age of 50.
And a festival this weekend features young musicians, but very old music.
The children are adjudicated in the areas of piano and strings. They play on modern instruments. But the significant thing is that they're playing Baroque compositions.
Lake Effect is next, after this news update. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. Thank you so much for tuning in today. The Milwaukee Bucks will open their home basketball season November 2nd against the Toronto Raptors. As they have since 1988, they'll call the BMO Harris Bradley Center home. But in February, a new commissioner will take over in the NBA, and Adam Silver is on the record as saying he doesn't believe that Bradley Center is up to NBA standards. Vague proposals for how to accomplish a new downtown arena have been in the air for some time, and Bucks owner Herb Cole has pledged to contribute some significant amount to get it done. But as Doug Russell writes in Milwaukee Magazine, the Bucks' future here is far from certain. He's with us now to dig a little deeper into the issue. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
Let's start with a ticking clock idea. What is the NBA's concern with the Bradley Center? Why does the league care if there are more restaurants or luxury boxes or other high-priced amenities here?
Because all of the other owners are in partnership with, you know, Herb Cole. And there is revenue sharing in the NBA. And when there are teams that aren't generating as much revenue specifically with their buildings, that's when the league starts to get involved. And, you know, they look at the situation and they see all of the other revenue generating amenities that other arenas around the NBA have. And they look at the ones that have the deficiencies. And there are a couple of buildings that have glaring deficiencies right now. Two of them are in Northern California, in Oakland and in Sacramento. And those two buildings are scheduled for demolition, and there's a plan to replace those buildings. There's no plan yet here in Milwaukee. And that's why Adam Silver, who's going to be the incoming commissioner of the NBA in February when David Stern steps down after 30 years at the helm, he was in town about 3-4 weeks ago. And he said, you know, Milwaukee's part of our culture. Milwaukee is part of the NBA. The Bradley Center is a nice building that has served its purpose, but it needs to be replaced.
Well, and the average fan looks at it and says, hey, the Bucks ended up with a better record than a lot of teams last year and a lot of teams with nicer and more modern arenas. But at the end of the day, what the fans see as a victory isn't necessarily what the league sees as a victory.
Well, that's true. And you also have to keep in mind that you know, wins and losses on the court are but a small part of the entire pie as far as the NBA is concerned. And fans are concerned about wins and losses, and they should be. But owners are businessmen, and businessmen are concerned about bottom lines. And, you know, there's this adage among some in the NBA that, well, the NBA as a league doesn't care about small market teams. Well, three out of the four teams in the Western Conference playoffs last year were in markets that were smaller than Milwaukee, in Memphis, in San Antonio, which, at least according to the Nielsen ratings, is a smaller market than Milwaukee, and then, of course, Oklahoma City. And Oklahoma City has been a marvelous success story as a small market that has embraced the NBA, and a really small market that's embraced the NBA. And Memphis has had their growing pains as well, but as long as good basketball decisions are being made, that's what is going to spell whether or not you're going to get wins or losses on the court, not off the court.
Well, and so let's talk about the connection between wins and losses and economics. There has not been a lot of grassroots buzz about the need for a new arena here and the need to keep the team in Milwaukee. Does that change if the Bucks put together a winning season? Does the needle start to move if the Bucks, you know, they're clearly not going to win the conference, but if they do a lot better this year?
Oh, it helps. And I think that that's one of the reasons that Herb Cole has – it's hard not to say Senator Cole, but yeah, I guess you can still say Senator Cole. It's one of the reasons that Senator Cole has never embraced the idea of tanking. He doesn't even like the word tanking. What I mean by tanking is intentionally not putting forth your best effort in an effort to then get a better draft choice, and then you can get perhaps a player like a LeBron James or a Kevin Durant or some of these superstars that are currently playing in the National Basketball Association. He's always wanted to put out the best team that they could possibly do. So having a winning season, and they were in the playoffs last year. They got swept by Miami. And there was a lot of dissension at the end of last season as well. But having a winning season and building that momentum, it certainly helps, at least as far as building some goodwill with your fans and trying to build the grassroots.
Although you make the point that the Bucks' record really has not been very good overall since mm-hmm. Herb Kohl took over as owner of this team since he bought the team. Is this in some way chickens coming home to roost for Herb Kohl not going all the way and putting a better team on the court?
I think Herb Kohl has tried to put a better team on the court. Sometimes, and I spoke with some former members of the Bucks front office. Larry Harris was quoted in the story. There was another individual that was not – he was quoted in the story, but just on a condition of anonymity. And the overwhelming sense is Herb Kohl cares about the fans. He desperately wants to win. He just doesn't know how to win.
And nobody would say a bad word about Herb Kohl.
No. I mean, even those that he fired, Larry Harris being one, has nothing but glowing things to say about this man who hauled him into the office one day and said, "You can't work for me anymore." So I think that's pretty remarkable, even though, someone who had a very high profile position and his father had a very high profile position with the Bucks got fired by Herb Kohl. Kind of looks at it like him as this beloved grandfatherly figure almost.
You're right about the business leadership that's getting behind this, Tim Sheehy for starters. What about political leadership? Why is this arena idea such a difficult thing for politicians to want to stick their necks out on?
Two words, George P. Tech. It goes back to the Miller Park debate of 15, 16, 17 years ago. And George P. Tack, if some of your listeners may not be familiar with him, he was the state senator from Racine who at the last minute, 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock in the morning in Madison, changed his vote on the Miller Park, ultimately wound up being a 5-county sales tax, and he wound up being recalled from office from that. It's a political hot potato right now, and nobody wants to stick their necks out right now because – taxes are too high, most people believe. And what are we getting for those taxes? And why should a billionaire owner and multimillionaire players be subsidized by we, the taxpayers? And that's the ultimate, tug of war that goes on in communities all over the country in regards to public financing for these venues.
You write a lot about the Oklahoma City example, mm-hmm. and a lot of people are pointing to with the idea that they were able to pass a limited tax to support a new arena in a pretty conservative place. The tax also supported a variety of other civic projects. Does anyone have a sense for whether that might work in Milwaukee?
It probably wouldn't because Oklahoma City literally had nothing when they began their MAPS project. Metropolitan Area Projects is short for MAPS in Oklahoma City. And they did that in three different referenda. And their motto was, look, we've got nothing here. We've got to build something here. And if you don't invest in your community, we're not going to really have much of a community to, want to live in, work in, grow our families in. So what they did, I think the Sacramento model is probably closer to what Milwaukee did. But what they did in Oklahoma City was they said, this is what this is going to be earmarked for. We're going to raise all the money before we put shovel in dirt. And that's what they did. And after the first time that they did that, the taxpayers kind of got the idea that, okay, they're being pretty diligent with what our investment is, and we will then approve the next two referenda, and it's worked marvelously for
them. And so talk about the Sacramento model. What did Sacramento do that Milwaukee might stand to learn from?
They have a public-private partnership, and I think that's the only way that this is going to get done. But they didn't raise any taxes in a community that is already taxed to the hilt, as are all communities in California. Their financial issues are very well documented. But what they did was they took the parking revenues from the city-owned lots and the city-owned spots on the street. Every time you plug the meter, that goes to paying the public portion of the new Sacramento arena that is going to be built in the next couple of years. Kind of an ingenious approach that their mayor, Kevin Johnson, went toward.
What are the chances that the needle moves on this conversation at all before the 2014 election?
Yeah, that's a great question, Mitch. I'm not sure. An inside source says that Governor Walker doesn't want to touch it until he is either voted out of office or reelected, and then it would be the next governor. And you could probably say the same thing about Mayor Barrett as well, whether or not he's going to seek out another term as mayor of Milwaukee. I think sports fans should be a little bit disappointed in that. But again, it's so political. And if you look back at Act 10 from Governor Walker's first term in office, he did that right away. And he spent the last 3 years, kind of save the recall election, the last 3 years trying to maybe move more toward the center as opposed to the right. And I think that that's kind of the model that you're looking at with this as well.
So what do the experts say about the potential economic impact of a team leaving town? There's some disagreement about what the real hit is.
Yeah, it all depends on what economist you want to believe. And you know what they say about statistics. Statistics don't lie, but liars use statistics. So I could throw a million numbers at you, and there would be someone else who would counter that. From everyone that I have spoken to, there is more of a prestige factor with having an NBA team or a professional, major league professional sports team than there is an actual economic benefit from that, save for a community like Green Bay where there's not a whole lot to do other than being kind of engulfed in the Packerdom, right, if you will. But in a city like Milwaukee, the effect is smaller because you've got other sporting avenues like the Brewers or Marquette or even the Wave or the Admirals or, you know, UWM basketball or something like that. But that money that would otherwise go to the Bucks might be spent at the Art Museum or the Symphony or, you know, doing something else with that disposable income as opposed to going to the Bucks games. So there's a prestige factor. I don't know if there's a huge economic factor that goes into that. And as a sports fan, it pains me to admit that, but, you know, that's the truth of the matter.
It's hard to quantify a blow to the ego.
Very much so. Very much so.
Doug Russell, thanks so much.
Absolutely. Thanks, Mitch.
Doug Russell's article on the future of the Bucks and the Bradley Center is in the October issue of Milwaukee Magazine. In his other life, Russell covers sports across town at WTMJ Radio. There are rumblings of negotiations in Washington that could end the federal government shutdown. But contentious words from some politicians and some regular people continue about the future of the Affordable Care Act. And Lake Effect essayist Alex Runner says that is something we can't afford.
Nearly every American, myself included, knows someone who doesn't have health insurance. We know educated, hardworking, family-supporting citizens of this great nation who simply don't have what amounts to a basic necessity in the 21st century. Those of us who are fortunate enough to work for businesses, nonprofits, or governmental entities that provide health care benefits, we win. Those of us who currently find ourselves unemployed, underemployed, or self-employed, we lose. Certain people pay very little for life-saving medicine and procedures. Others might lose their life savings. That's not hyperbole. That's not exaggeration. It's the simple truth, and it happens all the time. One person pays $100, while another person pays $100,000 for the very same treatment. In no way, shape, or form is this capitalism. In fact, it's corruption. This is not the free market. It's racketeering. And there's plenty of blame to go around. Doctors who exchanged honor and house calls for fatter wallets and slimmer souls. Health insurers who never tire of buying low and selling high when it comes to human health. Ambulance-chasing lawyers who love to brag about winning far more than any injury is worth. The rest of us who, to quote an accountant from 300 years ago, sit back in our embarrassment of riches, screaming bloody murder if we have to shell out a few dollars more for our copay, never even noticing the fellow citizens who line up outside the ER for basic health needs, whining about the price of gas, patting ourselves on the back for our false frugality, self-soothing our self-centeredness, and blaming every problem on the government boogeyman. We're not acting like adults. We're acting like children. We think that compromise is a weakness, but any kid who can't compromise gets put in a timeout. So the current predicament makes perfect sense. We've put the once great nation of the United States in a timeout. Know what Abraham Lincoln, the founder of the Republican Party, was often called? The Great Compromiser. But this generation confuses that kind of strength with weakness. People who compromise look to the interests of others instead of solely satisfying themselves. Compromise is humility, compromises leadership. Compromise is American, especially when it comes to health care. The stakes couldn't be higher, which is why the right to life is spelled out in our founding document. The debate is literally about life and death for millions of our fellow citizens, military veterans who fight tooth and nail for freedom but come home unable to afford surgery. Is this the greatest country on earth? One where we don't care whether our fellow man is on the brink of financial ruin because he can't afford a routine procedure? One where a single mother has to work three jobs to pay for her child's medicine? The problem isn't the Affordable Care Act. It's not Obamacare. The problem is us. We, the people, are the problem. The reason we don't have the American government right now is because we don't deserve the American government right now. Maybe we will someday soon, but not right now. Not when we behave like this. Today, we don't deserve to be called Americans.
Lake Effect essayist Alex Runner lives and writes in Sherman Park. A version of this essay also ran in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Keep listening. When we return, we'll talk about some of the many accents and dialects that shape how we talk in Wisconsin and learn how Wisconsin talk sounds different than what we'd hear elsewhere in the country. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Tyke. Pickle Patch, Bubbler, Tavern Belly, Brats. Wisconsinites have regularly employed a colorful and unique vocabulary thanks to multiple waves of immigration from the 1800s through the present. But there's also incredible diversity in language use in different areas of the states and even within single cities. A new book written by a collection of linguistic scholars expounds on our state's history, politics, and culture towards language use. Eric Ramey is professor of English language and linguistics at UW-Madison. Thomas Purnell is professor of English at UW-Madison. They're the co-editors of and contributors to Wisconsin Talk, Linguistic Diversity in the Badger State. They talked with Lake Effect's Rachel Bloom about Wisconsin's rich cultural and linguistic heritage, which extends to both accents and dialects.
Wisconsin has been known for having a particular sort of accent or dialect from the upper Midwest area. And people tend to joke about that and think primarily in those terms. But there's a lot going on with language here that's sort of separate from English. In our book, we have a chapter on Native American languages, and I think this is the starting point. But also taking through immigration, both old immigrants like German, Polish, and also new immigrants such as Hmong and Spanish speakers. We picked four communities that we were very interested in because we felt that they had unique characteristics. So we picked Milwaukee because we felt like with the African-American community and the intersection with and sort of the issue of race and language, that was really important. We also picked Wausau because we felt like that was important because they had two groups of old immigrants and two groups of new immigrants. And we wanted to try to see how we could help them to learn from the past of the old groups. We also picked Mineral Point because we felt like that was very different. It's a different part of the state altogether in terms of the speech patterns. We felt like that was an important
– Southwestern.
Southwestern, right. And then we picked Rhinelander, which also was important for sort of as a center for Native American language issues as well as also for issues dealing with the North Woods aspect, that both the perception of North Woods individuals and also their language might be different from sort of this Germanic – you know, dominant area in the southeast.
I noticed that in many instances, members of various immigrant and native communities were forced to assimilate their language and culture and conform to standard English. But then I was surprised to read that Wisconsin actually established an emigration office in the mid-1800s, specifically to attract Germans to settle the state. Do you think that this cultural acceptance of Germanic culture affects the way we speak in Wisconsin today?
That's a good question. Not being from Wisconsin here, I think the history of actually trying to recruit or advertise Germans to come here specifically explains and provides, you know, the basis for why so many Germans came here. We can see the hallmarks of the large amounts of European migration in here in contemporary dialects of Wisconsin. But whether this actually leads to more acceptance of immigrants or immigrant languages here or there, I'm not entirely sure. I mean, I think that's still for us to decide in the future of how we treat new immigrant languages and old immigrant languages too.
But I think when you look at all these cases in the book, the immigrants come here, period, and then language issues follow. And so those language issues and follow sort of fall out in a particular pattern. And there's a lot to be learned from some of those patterns, like the German pattern, how German, in a sense, was used in Milwaukee particularly or throughout the state, but then has sort of given way to English in many ways and how they were in tension for a while. And then you see that now, I mean, with Spanish and with Hmong, how within those communities there's also a tension and how there's a transition taking place. And we have a lot to learn from what happened with those older immigrants with the new immigrants.
That is true. In my personal opinion, one of the most interesting things here is actually the difference between the older immigrants and the newer immigrants, in that it appeared that it took the older immigrants, so the good old German immigrants, much, much, much longer to transition over to English as opposed to the new immigrants, especially the Spanish-speaking immigrants. They are transitioning over to English much quicker now, as quickly as they possibly can, as opposed to the older immigrants that took 3-4 generations to do so.
And some of that has to do with societal pressures. So there's a lot of framework with regard to schools, churches, and family life in terms of having immigrants come in or old immigrants come in. And with the state, in a sense, advertising come here, you had some setup and some tolerance of that. And I think nowadays there are still churches. There are churches that have Hmong that's spoken in or Spanish. You'll see once those start to switch over to English, then you're going to start to lose a lot of the language. There's not a lot of the other structure. There are, you know, tiendas and so on and so forth, and those help maintain. So having, say, a hairdresser who speaks Hmong and then the Hmong go there, that'll preserve the contact because you're engaging it in the language at that point. And without some of those structures and some of those peripheral things, the turnover is much faster. I think some of the pressures in society now are not as supportive of language maintenance as they were in the past.
So there is a big community element in the practice of these languages.
Correct.
What are some of the linguistic mannerisms that are found in Wisconsin, and why is it important that we know about them?
It's always important to sort of know where you're from. That's one aspect of it. And it's also important to know where the other person that you're talking to is from. And identity and cohesion in a conversation is important to anybody. So usually when students live in Wisconsin and then they go out of the state for a while, all of a sudden it's apparent that something's different about their speech. And there's a number of markers, both in syntax and in the sounds, and then in also the words that they use. And those markers mark them out as being different from the place that they've gone to visit. Something that we might actually associate more with Chicago, which is de Bears, de Bulls. But you find this also in Packers, right, where people will make an S sound when it should be like a Z sound. But this happens in German, it happens in Dutch, it happens in a number of languages. And we wanted to look at the influence. We found that younger speakers actually took that as a marker and worked that into their speech more often than, say, even their previous generation. And that was remarkable. So that got us thinking that there's a lot going on in Wisconsin that's really interesting.
One of my favorite discussions in class is telling the class of, you know, nice Wisconsin-born students and all of you Wisconsin listeners that Wisconsin is unique and weird in having the past tense of the verb to dive into a pool as dove. And this is unusual with the rest of the country. And so when people occasionally look down on somebody for using the wrong tense of something, it makes people rethink their judgments when they find out it's like, oh, by the way, you know, your behavior of I dove into the pool, people not from around here may hear you say that and think that, you know, you're uneducated because obviously the past tense is dived. So one of the things of knowing what are the unique markers of a particular community or a speech group, I think allows people to think about their own judgments about differences in other groups of speeches.
And you bring up an interesting point, I think, about what we consider standard English and how there are actually many different types of standard English. Some forms might use a different past tense, like dove, as you said. In academic settings, what we call formal standard English is usually used. But what makes this different from some of the other forms of standard English? What about informal standard English?
Oh, the different types of formal versions of language is really defined by kind of who makes the decision or who defines what is standard or not. So formal standard English is defined by groups of experts and basically books. And we also want to recognize that the only really real version of formal standard English is written English, is that it's only when it's written can it actually be formal standard. And you can look up in a book, Descriptive Grammar of English, of the writing rules of this is how you do it. The informal standard of English is a variety spoken, and this is completely defined by local communities. So using dove as the past tense of dive is standard here in Wisconsin because that's how the community behaves. The community has decided for that. It is not standard, say, in Western Pennsylvania where I grew up. And so the standards really differentiate by who has the power to decide what they are. And the version that everybody thinks exists, this formal standard English, is just purely in books. Whereas the actual, you know, in my opinion, more important, the local informal standard is completely community driven. And it's the community that you grow up with and feel most comfortable with and belonging to. Everybody learns what the standards are there on their own. And then you can see where people deviate from them.
The greatest deviation usually occurs in ones that are ethnically affiliated. Historically, in the United States, that's been with the African-American English community. In terms of the choices that that community makes about language, they're not really choices in the sense that we think, oh, okay, I'm going to make this choice. I have a choice that way. But in terms of the way that it's developed over time and the whole history of African-American English, it sets itself out from standard white English in many particular ways. So that whole issue about standardization, particularly in the schools, in terms of the workplace, those are going to come up strongest in communities that have the most divergent speech forms, generally African-American English speech communities and also, say, even the Chicano English speech community.
Do you think that it's important that children are introduced to these different forms of English in school, that they have an understanding of dialects different than their own?
That's actually important. So there's two ways to take your particular question. One way to take it is a child who speaks a non-standard variety, should they be exposed, say, to other varieties such as standard? And so that's generally the sort of big thing talking about education and how non-standard dialect speakers should conform or not conform. But also the other way around, for standard students who are close to the standard, individuals close to the standard, should they be exposed to more non-standard varieties? And I think in many ways they are exposed to non-standard varieties through media and so on and so forth, also through their friends if they have more contact with non-standard speakers. And I think that's healthy just to understand it. If they also understand that the forms that other people speak are not right or wrong, then they don't develop some of the biases that we use that as a flag for that person who's different later in life. And it's very important. Although language gets used that way sort of automatically, we use it as a flag and ends up being used in discriminatory ways. So I think it's important for children early on in schools not to be sort of homogenizing the community and then making those who can't manage that variety as being very different.
I really don't think the idea that kids aren't being exposed to varieties of non-standard dialects can be maintained at all, because even in standard Wisconsin English, all the children are being exposed both to the informal standard but then also the vernacular non-standard. You know, so like all of the kids know all the bad words. They hear us when we're talking freely. And so they're aware of variation in language there too. So if we begin to ask the question of like, is it helpful or harmful of them being exposed to other informal standard or other informal non-standards, they're already seeing and aware of the variation to begin with. And so I actually think in school, if you actually – the younger that you can start talking to the kids about this and teaching them about this, the better they can begin to manipulate and use and know, you know, you don't say those words because you don't say those words in those situations. And, you know, this other person talks differently, but that's just because they're from a different neighborhood and it doesn't mean anything like that. And so you can begin the discussion of manipulating language behaviors for everybody, which everybody does – in more productive ways. You know, so you teach people to go to job interviews in you know, nice clothes. You know, you teach people to use nice language when you go to a job interview. But you know, when you're sitting around on the playground with your friends, you don't have to use nice language, and it's okay.
Eric Ramey and Tom Purnell, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Eric Ramey is professor of English language and linguistics at UW-Madison. Thomas Purnell is a professor of English at UW-Madison. They're co-editors of and contributors to Wisconsin Talk, Linguistic Diversity in the Badger State, published by UW Press. They spoke with Rachel Bloom in September. They'll talk about the book at the Wisconsin Festival of Books in Madison next week. Another break now, but when we return, we'll learn about a digital effort to collect the history of Latina activists in Wisconsin. This is Lake Effect from WUWM. More of Lake Effect now. I'm Mitch Tyke. Across the country, the story of Chicana history is being collected in a project called Somos Latinas. The project came to Wisconsin in 2012 through Dr. Tess Arenas, a Milwaukee native who is the director of service learning and a faculty associate for the Chicana and Latina Studies Department at UW-Madison. She created Somos Latinas Digital History Project, in which she and her students document the stories of Latina activists in Wisconsin. Arenas' work will be the feature of an event tomorrow evening at Alverno College benefiting the project. Arenas tells Lake Effect Stephanie Lecce why she and her students are focusing on preserving Latina voices.
Well, we've had a breakthrough in the past decade of new books coming out, both scholarly and semi-scholarly, about Latinos in Milwaukee and, of course, like I said, Esperanza in Waukesha. And they're terrific additions to the literature and long-awaited. However, the presence of women has always been problematic in the literature. We're absent. And as a feminist, a scholar, an activist, when the Chicana por mi Raza National Project, collecting women's archives of activists, approached me to consider doing a Wisconsin version, I said, when can we start? And so what we've done is given undergraduate students the opportunity to hear the stories of powerful, empathetic, action-oriented Latinas over the age of 50 throughout Wisconsin. And there are many interviews. We've gotten over 30 thus far. We've been at it for a year and a half. And we think we'll exceed our goal of 50. And if all goes well, there'll be a text written.
Why is a project like this so crucial and so important to document now?
We've targeted Latinas over the age of 50 before we lose them. And I'll give you a really good example. We interviewed a dynamic woman, 77 years old, who's been active in Racine, Milwaukee, and Madison. Her first interview was spectacular. My students were spellbound and asked could they do a part two because her life was so rich with experience. And she agreed. We showed up. The crew was ready, cameras, interviewers, and no one answered the door. It was getting late. We're pounding on the windows, calling out her name. She lived alone. I finally reached her daughter in Racine and found out she had been hospitalized the night before. We never got part two. And that's why we're targeting women over 50.
What are students learning as they're collecting these interviews?
They get assigned a woman who we believe qualifies for inclusion in Somos Latinas. They go out and research to find out about these women. They develop their own interview questions. The student then, with the team and I, go visit the women wherever they choose to be interviewed. A student conducts the interview. Another student records it. Another student edits into DVDs. And another set of students and I work on collecting the archives of these women. And the DVDs and the archives will be part of the Somos Latina collection in the Wisconsin Historical Society. They're a partner also. So the students are learning field research at an undergraduate level. And what I'm finding is that the students, as a result, are thinking about graduate school, which is my goal. of introducing more complex ideas at the undergraduate level to encourage graduate and terminal degrees. And the students love the work. And I tie it to the course that I'm teaching. It is not a side project. They use their experiences in the field to learn the course material better. Because the research says when you do service learning or community-based research, you will retain the core information of a course at a much deeper level and much longer throughout your lifetime.
What kinds of questions are the students asking that's connecting what they're learning in the course with what they've found out about these women before they interview them?
What's a good example? Well, this semester, I have students in a class on the U.S.-Mexico border. And at first, the students said, what's the connection to Wisconsin activists? And then I explained that historically, Wisconsin has a constant influx of migrant workers who do cross the border and who are also U.S. citizens from Texas and Arizona and Florida. But many of these women have crossed the border or have border perceptions or border experiences. So in this case, not only are they going to ask these women about their activism in their local cities, they're going to ask them about their border experiences, perceptions, etc. So in each course, we add new questions that pertain to the course curriculum, as well as documenting these women's contributions in bilingual education, health and human services, running for office, opening businesses, etc.
Do you feel like this project is getting people to ask that question, why have Latina voices been excluded in the past?
Always. The Wisconsin Historical Society partner, Jonathan Nelson, chief archivist, has told me that in general, the priorities are for Latino, African American, Native American, and Asian history. And the Historical Society specializes in social and political movements. So on December 6th, the Office of Service Learning and Community-Based Research, where I'm also the director in the College of Letters and Science, will be hosting a forum for other faculty in these ethnic studies programs to think about how they might want to contribute to preserving history for their communities in Wisconsin.
What will be done with the videos of the interviews once they're all collected?
They would go to the Historical Society, and then working through the Department of Public Instruction, we're going to inform the K-12 and local colleges of their existence. And we will be creating lesson plans to be used, K-12 and college level. And then, once the districts and the colleges are aware of their existence, they can get copies of the DVDs, and they can either visit the Historical Society or go online and look at the archives.
What makes Wisconsin ripe to mine for these interviews and these stories to be told through Somos Latinas?
The migrant stream and the new influxes in communities across the state. Traditionally, when we think of Latinos in Wisconsin, we think of Racine, Kenosha, Waukesha, Milwaukee, Sheboygan. We're finding Latinas in newer communities, especially in the Fox Valley region, in Nina Menasha, Oshkosh, Appleton. We're also finding them in Beloit, Lake Geneva, Delavan. Delavan's an older community, too. But there's been a new influx over the past 15 years of Latinos who have settled in the Fox Valley and other northern regions of the state. And we want to document what they're doing.
Now, you're doing a fundraiser to benefit the Somos Latinas Digital History Project. Tell us a little bit about the event.
I'm the show. This is all student run, and I came to this kicking and screaming for several reasons. This is not about me. I don't care to be documented. And they wanted me to do it around my poetry, which I am very private with. So after several conversations, I succumb. And so the Alverno event is Friday evening, my alma mater. That was my condition. I would do this if I could do it at my alma mater to see the sisters who groomed me. Once again, and thank them. So it'll be a mix of poetry and interview.
Now, the theme of the evening is about Latina resiliency. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Sure. Like any working class woman, you know, we've had challenges in our lives. And I think that's how that title evolved. Like other women, you have marriages that fall apart, messy work situations, and I've been known to bounce back over and over. So I think that's where that came from.
Well, Dr. Tessa Reynas, thank you so much for giving us a peek at the Somos Latinas Digital History Project, and good luck at the event.
Oh, thank you so much.
Dr. Tessa Reynas is the Director of Service Learning and a Faculty Associate for the Chicana and Latina Studies Department at UW-Madison. Some of the work of that program includes participating in the Somos Latinas Digital History Project, and Reynas' work will be featured at the Night Exploring Latina Resiliency with La Tess fundraiser tomorrow evening at Alverno College. She spoke with Stephanie Lecce. One last break, and then a preview of upcoming Baroque offerings from the Ensemble Musical Offering. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. Fans of the early musical style known as Baroque will find two significant events in the coming days. This Saturday marks 8 hours of Baroque offerings at the Greater Milwaukee Baroque Festival held at Wisconsin Lutheran College in Wauwatosa. And the following day, a house concert to support the early music ensemble musical offering features music by Mozart, played by guest artist forte pianist Stephen Lubin, playing on a Stein forte piano. Joan Parsley is the Artistic Director of Musical Offering. She tells Lake Effect's Bonnie North how the festival evolved.
Well, it was very interesting. This festival has actually been going on for 6 years, and it was just a little gem, a well-kept secret. And the gentleman who is now president of the Wisconsin Federation of Music Clubs asked me 3 years ago to come and speak. Shortly after that, he said that he was having new responsibilities as president of the Wisconsin Federation. Would I be interested, would Musical Offering be interested in taking this festival over? And we were looking for a project that would really bind us to the community. And this is just wonderful. We couldn't be more thrilled to be working with the K through 12 students in our community.
Well, that was my next question, is who is this focused? It's a Baroque festival, but it's for children and young adults.
Yes, actually, it's a festival and competition. The children are adjudicated in the areas of piano and strings. They play on modern instruments. But the significant thing is that they're playing Baroque compositions from the huge repertoire that there is, up to 1850. And we're very specific about composers, about the kinds of editions of music or text or original editions of music that they perform. And they have to play two contrasting pieces for the adjudicators. And then depending on how they do, they're awarded cash prizes. And then we have a very special young artist showcase of free performance for the community of all of our winners next spring.
Okay, so it continues on through
the
winter.
Yeah.
While they're here, so it's a competition. Are they also getting classes during this time as well?
There are several things that are happening. There are demonstrations on the harpsichord. A lot of the children, the pianists, really love that. So I'm doing demonstrations and bringing one of my instruments. We'll have demonstrations of Baroque string instruments. There will be a master class, which is for more advanced students, with our guest speaker and guest artist. We always bring in someone now from the world of early music that can cross over into modern performance as well. And we have Stephen Lubin, who's doing that for us
this
year.
Wonderful forte pianist.
Yes.
I mean,
stellar.
I've heard any number of his recordings, and it's just wonderful stuff. Now, when students are introduced to Baroque instruments, what's the difference?
Well, it depends on what, if we're talking about winds or strings or keyboard. In Strings, we have a Summer Baroque Institute, which we also provide students with historical instruments, and they're set up differently. The string instruments are just set up differently and built differently than the modern instruments, and they're strung in gut. The bow is also different, and now we have invested, the corporation has invested in Baroque bows, and it's really the bow that makes the difference. You can actually use a Baroque bow on a modern instrument and get a very good sound and be able to use the historical technique of playing on those instruments.
So this is an opportunity for the kids to actually be introduced to
yes.
both the technique, the instruments, as well as maybe even the repertoire.
Well, the repertoire, and we have a humanities component where we look at a certain place in society where this music was during the time, and we have ornamentation, improvisation classes. It's a whole week during the summer. And then this festival is in the fall. So it means now that musical offering is really operating on a year-round basis.
Which is a big change.
Which is a big change from just having a concert series.
Now, the students that you work with in the summer, are some of them going to be participating in this weekend workshop?
Yes.
Oh, good.
And
so there's
so
that
the hope is,
as well. Yeah.
Yes, that that's going to feed the Baroque Institute, and the students in the Baroque Institute will have an opportunity to compete in the fall.
Do you find that the kids are really interested in the Baroque repertoire, in the Baroque music, you know, versus, say, any other period of classical music?
It's very interesting when the students come in because they really they have an inkling. You know, they've taken Suzuki violin or cello, and, of course, Suzuki method uses a lot of the Baroque music. Or they've played in their high school orchestra and have done something by Bach or Handel or Vivaldi. So they have an idea, at least, of the genre of music. But what's different is, of course, the technique. And that is an eye-opener to them. And then, you know, where this music fit in society. And the children just, they're like a sponge. They just soak it up. It's really an amazing thing to watch. And learning to play with musicians who they haven't met before, who may be coming in from other parts of the city. And it's just, it's fabulous.
How many participants will there be on the weekend?
Right now, we have 65 young pianists and string players who are competing.
That's exciting.
It's very exciting.
So are you breaking them up into things like doing trio sonatas and, you know, or?
No, it's solo repertoire right now. But we have plans for the future. We want to have a chamber music category. We also will eventually have a category for young people who are dedicated or becoming more dedicated to playing on the Baroque instruments themselves, because that's really where the industry in early music is going. And we see that coming out of places like Juilliard School of Music, which has just a fabulous endowment now for historical performance that was started 3 years ago.
So not only the performance practice and ornamentation and all of that, but actually the instruments themselves
yes.
that
right.
are either reproductions or restorations.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I find that fascinating because that's changed so much in the last 30 years. I mean, there was such a resurgence of interest in early music in the 70s.
Right.
And then the historic performance practice sort of came in and everybody was on that. But they were still using modern instruments.
That's right.
For the most part.
Yeah. What's interesting is that we do have a teacher, a string teacher, who has a small little harpsichord, a spinet, who wants to bring it in so that her students can be accompanied on harpsichord.
Nice.
That's – yes.
Which, of course, is the correct
– It would be nice.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. The modern piano is lovely, but it just has a different sound.
It is different.
It is different. Are you going to open it up eventually to wind players as well and brass players?
We would like to, and to vocalists. But right now we're taking a very conservative approach, and there's a lot – we see just tremendous potential with this festival. But as we go on, of course, the funding demands become greater. So we want to make sure that we're on a good footing right now with the teachers that we're working with and seeing these students. It's just like flowers blooming in a garden. It really is.
So what about musical offering? I know you're still having your concert series.
Yes, we have 5 concerts, and we're doing some playing in other places as well. Now.
So outside of Milwaukee?
Milwaukee, yes.
So where are you taking things?
Well, into the northern suburbs of Chicago and Madison. Those are really markets that we're beginning to develop now. And
well, that's
of course,
fantastic. You're going on the road.
Well, and we want to do more of that. We really do. But, you know, we still have each of our programs has a particular theme. We are bringing in some guest artists this season for the first time, really. 2 wonderful Baroque dancers in November. And then Jory Vinicor, who's a harpsichordist that was up for a Grammy nomination for his work in Rameau. And he's playing a wonderful C.P.E. Bach harpsichord concerto for our C.P.E. Bach anniversary celebration next May.
I didn't even realize it was his anniversary.
It is.
Yeah.
Yes.
And one of the great Bach sons,
right.
Carl Philipp Emanuel. Yes. And I always loved his music.
Oh, I think it's great. Yeah. And, you know, really when we came back to Milwaukee and kind of regenerated musical offering, it was all Bach. All J.S. Bach and his contemporaries. And we still have Bach is the basis of what we do. But now, you know, we're extending ourselves into the French repertoire with Rameau and Fauqueray and Marais and Lully and Campra. So we're looking at a lot of different things coming up in the next couple of years for the ensemble.
Well, and also there's a whole – the French repertoire is so different in terms of the technique and in terms of the interpretation. It's very different than the German and the Italian.
Oh, it is.
Yeah.
But, you know, the Germans like Telemann, we just did 2 of the Paris quartets the other night in performance for our opening concert. And we talked about, you know, his championing the French overture style. And one of the things that he wanted to do, he was highly celebrated. Composer and went to France in the autumn of 1737. He was invited and wrote these wonderful quartets in the Parisian style. And because of them, took composition to a whole new level. I mean, we'd known about the trio sonatas in Germany and Italy. All of a sudden, we have these fabulous quartets.
So and something new.
Something
right.
new. And the French were everywhere. You know, their influence was everywhere.
Well, I'm looking forward to it, and I hope at some point we can get you and the ensemble in the studio so we can hear some of this.
We would be happy to accommodate you.
All right. Well, we will make that happen once you get the festival over, and we'll try to get everything. But best of luck with this.
And we should let you know that this is free and open to the public. So if people want to come and hear these young students at the end of the day perform their winning pieces or attend the masterclass with Stephen Lubin starting at 1 o'clock, they are welcome to do so.
And we'll put all the information on our website how to do it.
Okay.
Joan Parsley, as always, such a pleasure to have you in the studio.
Thank you so much, Bonnie. We appreciate being here.
Joan Parsley is the artistic director of the ensemble Musical Offering. She spoke with Bonnie North. You'll find a link to information about this weekend's concert and the Greater Milwaukee Baroque Festival from WUWM.com/Lake Effect. And that's Thursday's edition of the program. I'm Mitch Teich. Thank you so much for being with us today, and I sure hope you'll tune in again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio. We're NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh Air is next. It's 11 o'clock.